Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting live from our studios in New York City. Just returned today after 3 months away filming. Today, we're going to explore patients with depression benefit from mindfulness-based therapies. 7 Ayurvedic herbs to destroy colon and other cancers quickly. Pycnogenol helps with heart disease and inflammation and diabetes. Pomegranate promises a lot of benefit if you have any inflammatory condition, and most illnesses have inflammation as an important part of them. That's our health and nutrition, but a lot more on health and nutrition. From our environment today, a very comprehensive discussion on the toxic legacy of uranium mining in New Mexico, where I was. This is from Dar Jamal from Truthout. And they've done absolutely nothing to help the people nor clean up the environment. In the second part of our program, we're going to look at the issue of the miseducation of the American elite and the disadvantages of an elitist education. But hold on. We've been told there's only advantages to an elitist education. Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Radcliffe, Brown, Stanford. Not true. My guest will be taking us in depth because he was a former English professor at Yale University for over a decade, and he has some unique insights. We've been talking about this for a long time, and I wanted him on because in the new major feature, Poverty Inc., that I've been filming, I continue to see the impact of people who come from elite educational backgrounds who make decisions without any spiritual or moral compass involved. So we'll talk about that in depth. After my health and nutrition segment, I'm going to give you the latest on why I believe that the bureaucracies in America are self-serving, are corrupt, and negatively impact us. Now, that doesn't mean all people working within all bureaucracies. It means that there is no accountability to these people, just like the police. There's no accountability at all. Do you think for a second that the police killing people, tasering them, harassing them, beating them, in prisons, in Rikers Island, on the streets, do you think that this would occur if they felt that they would be held accountable? I'll give you an example of that. If time permits today, I'll also give you the new law that would allow, actually encourage the privatization of our water. Wow. Now just look at it this way. Right now, we have 20 states that are in drought. 9 of those states are in substantial drought, including the highest category, extreme drought, critical. Why in the world would you want or even allow private corporations to go in there and be the only ones who could extract that water and sell it to people? There is where just a lack of ethics and common sense abound. I'll give you the latest on that. If time permits, I will also play you a segment from an Irish legislator speaking out about his opinion about what's going on in Gaza. And it's rare to hear someone this articulate. Now, he lived in Gaza. He has a lot of friends in the Jewish community. He is gay. So he's very familiar firsthand. So if time permits, we'll hear from him. If not, tomorrow. If you'd like to watch this segment, now that I'm back in studio, you can go to Ustream, that's U-S-T-R-E-A-M, the channel, and search for Gary Null. And I'll be broadcasting now for the next several months from our studios in New York City. If for any reason at any of the stations around the United States or Canada you're listening, for some reason you don't hear me and the time I'm normally on there, you can always just pick up a phone and call, because you can always listen over the telephone. That number is 401-401-401. 401-347-0456. 401-347-0456. If that's busy, 712-432-7231. 712-432-7231. And we've just passed 11 million minutes of people listening. So a lot of people are doing that. We have millions, tens of millions of Americans suffering from depression. Normally, they would struggle. Some will seek professional help, and if they're lucky, get into the hands of a humanistic, holistic psychologist, or a psychotherapist, or a psychiatrist, where the pharmaceutical approach or the medical model of saying you have a brain chemical imbalance and dopamine, serotonin, and this drug, this selective serotonin reuptake inhibiting drug, Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, Effexor, will help it. No, it won't, and it could cause you to kill yourself. Suicidal ideation, homicide, extreme acting out are side effects. Or you might be one of those people that just say, I give up. In which case you suffer from an apathy period and you eat whatever you want, comfort foods, and nothing good happens. But there's something that can benefit you. This is from the Journal of Psychosomatic Research. It says the following. Patients with depression benefit from mindfulness-based therapy, which leads to reduced healthcare visits. A mindfulness-based therapy, which we discuss on this program, for depression, has added benefit to the patient on several levels. A, because they're less likely to act out in a negative way, and B, anyone who receives mindfulness-based cognitive therapy generally shows a significant reduction in non-mental health care visits over a one-year period. Now, that's generally meditation. So that's a big benefit. Quote, we speculate that mindfulness-based cognitive therapy has elements that could help people who are high health care utilizers manage their distress without needing to go to a doctor. When I did a health support group 5 years ago, specifically for people with depression, and to get in, you had to have a letter from your psychologist or psychiatrist or family physician saying that you were suffering from clinical depression. More often than not, they were on meds. And we took one issue every couple of months. But throughout all of it, the cleansing up the system, the motivation to get up and exercise, to exercise then twice a day, go to a gym, bike, go out power walking, even in the winter, go to a place like a mall and walk. All of that is beneficial. But also getting rid of foods that are known to cause candida, like sugar, any sugary food or refined carbohydrate. And then the candida, which are these yeast, go through the bloodstream up to the brain and cause brain fog and depression. To be able to get off the caffeine, which causes this roller coaster of high, low, high, low, high, low. When you have the sugar, you have the rush. When you have the caffeine, you have the rush. And then when it wears off in 10 to 15 minutes, you have the down, which causes the body to want it back. It's no different than heroin. So breaking those habits and being mindful of each choice you make and stopping and saying, what is the likely outcome to the choice I'm about to make? Will it benefit me or will it be against me? Within a year of that health support group, 90% of the people no longer had any signs of depression. They had resolved their issues and were leading a healthier life. So when we go about yoga, when we go about meditation, when we go about food consciousness, living foods, healthy foods, slow eating, slow cooking, farmers market, organic versus GMO, we began one door opening after another until one day, we're making all these really vibrantly healthy choices. And then we no longer have the depression. And this is simply one piece of that information. We have a lot of people who are terrified about cancer, and rightly so, because our current ways of dealing with cancer are almost universally limited, or out-and-out contribute to the death of a person. It says something when the second largest morgue in America is in a cancer hospital. And I'm always puzzled by how we can praise as noble anyone working with an orthodox approach to cancer who dies. Well, they put up the good fight. Oh, everybody wanted them to live. But did anyone question the model being used and its results? And the answer is never. We'll have marches. You've all seen the Wear Pink and a March for the Cure. But no one ever says, that $25 I gave to March today, where does it actually go? Where does it end up? How, in any form, is this actually contributing? Well, the reality is most of the money for most charities in the United States goes to the charity just to support its own growth and continuation and continuity. And it goes to the big rents and the big salaries, the people that administer it, and legions of people that are in supportive capacities. Then it goes to insider researchers, those who are favored. And I've had this come directly from people who were on the receiving end of unlimited grants for the rest of their life without ever having a single positive outcome. I even once had a physician come to the radio station, a scientist. And after I got off the air and I was leaving, he said, are you Gary? And I said, yes. He said, could I take a moment of your time? I said, sure. And I said, what can I help you with? He said, I'm one of the people who listen to your program, but can't say that I actualize a whole lot of it. But I just had to get this off my chest. It's just been living with me, and I've had this guilt for such a long time. I read your series on the politics of cancer. I watched one of your documentaries on the suppression of alternative cancer therapies. I'm in the cancer industry. I've been getting large research grants, as much as I want, for over 20 years. My group and myself have never come up with anything that justifies this. It's just that we're politically connected. We know the people, and everyone sits on someone else's board. And when it comes time to review your application, one of your colleagues will approve it, or one of your friends. In return, you will approve theirs. It's a vicious, incestuous circle, and I'm sick of it. And I said, well, then go out on your own. He said, I'm a coward also. He said, I have a very high standard of living. I have kids in colleges, Ivy League schools. I have an awful lot of bills. So no matter how much I make, I spend more than I make. And then the more everyone spends, the more they spend the next year and the next year. And he said, I just want you to know, you were doing an editorial last week, and that's why I'm here today, one of your commentaries, where you were really challenging the cancer establishment, that they have all this power, and they have unlimited money, and they control everything in the media, and they have failed miserably. And I'm part of that failure. I just wanted to tell you that. I asked him his name. He said, I'm not going to tell you my name. You won't know who I am. I'm one of the people who are probably a million of us out there. It's just that I know better. And he left. My research would show that he was not alone. So when it comes to cancer, just remember, more people die every year using only, exclusively, orthodox cancer, chemotherapy and radiation, and because of the therapy itself, than die of the cancer itself. Hard to imagine. The statistics are accurate. So what else could you do? There's a lot you can do. Let me just share from the Natural Society some of the numerous Ayurvedic treatments. Now, Ayurvedic goes back a long ways. Clear back 700 BC, they were talking about the Sashastra, which is one of their major sciences of balancing the body, healing the body, and the doshas, returning to balance. And if you're in balance, then cancer and other diseases will not appear. In fact, they'll help be eliminated the more you rebalance. Well, not everyone will rebalance enough, and frequently the disease will manifest in death. But I've also had enough experience saying if people do everything without compromise and to the maximum level possible, then I've also seen people reverse diseases that no one thought they would ever survive. So I'm just going to give you seven herbs. Now, these herbs bring balance to the doshas in helping to minimize and or helping control in the cancering process. Now, I don't see cancer as a noun. I see it as a verb, cancering, rather than a cancer. Therefore, I see it's a process, and processes we can control, processes we can change. Nouns we frequently can't. So when I come from, they said, oh, you got the big C. Is it suddenly how that was a death sentence? There's nothing you could do about it. It was inevitable. No, it's not inevitable. You can do things. Write these down, please. Ashwagandha. Ashwagandha. This is a very powerful adaptogenic herb, and it's been used in dozens of Ayurvedic medical protocols, and it increases your resistance to disease. It gives you energy. It's extremely beneficial for all cancers. Garlic. Now, black garlic is, in my opinion, the best garlic, but organic garlic. There are dozens of double-blind studies showing that garlic is a powerful treatment for cancer. Then you have green tea. And the green tea can help inhibit the formation of cancer cells. Also, there's rich catechin polyphenols within, and that can help kill cancer cells without harming any of the regular cells. So then we have what is called celandine, C-E-L-A-N-D-I-N-E. This is very good. It's a member of the poppy family, and it's been used to treat colon cancer, stimulate the immune system. Aloe vera, the whole leaf aloe. Look where you buy your aloe. Make sure it's not grown outside of the United States. Don't look where it's packaged. Look where it's grown. I went down to the Dominican Republic with my brothers, and we went up into the mountains and saw the big aloe farms up there. The aloe was sprayed heavily with banned DDT. I actually saw the canister. And they take it into a big shed. It looks like an airplane hangar shed with a dirt floor. And there, what looks like a checkout counters, wooden counters, about a dozen of them, with 55-gallon barrels. These guys sit there and souffle with fish souffle knives, the aloe, taking the leaf and throwing it away and putting the gel in canisters, then pouring some kind of chemical preservative, and off it goes to the United States. Now, in the United States, it'll be processed and labeled. But what you want is you want the whole leaf organically grown aloe. So if it doesn't say organically grown, then don't buy it. But if it does, then aloe vera and apple cider vinegar, organic, unfiltered apple cider vinegar, combined together, it's terrific for eliminating toxins. It's one of the best things for your digestive system. It is great for any inflammation in your intestines as well. And it kills candida, which can contribute to cancers. It lowers your blood glucose level, so it helps diabetics. It's terrific for people who otherwise would be using some toxic chemicals in the intestine. Then we have ginger root. Now, I grow ginger, and ginger has a wonderful, beautiful flower that comes out. It can get very tall, and get 15, 20 feet tall, but it's in the root, and you get a good root, and you peel it, and then you juice about 1 to 2 inches of that root per day. Now, you should dilute it, and dilute it in green tea, and put some Manuka honey in it, and that's a great tonic. So ginger's been used in Ayurvedic, almost all the different Ayurvedic remedies have ginger, but specifically for colon cancer. And then finally you have turmeric, T-U-R-M-E-R-I-C. It is a phenomenally powerful herb. Within turmeric are curcuminoids, and the curcuminoids found in the turmeric roots cause colon cancer cells to self-destruct. So that's another thing that you could use. So those are just some things that I believe more people should use. And finally, something can help with heart disease and inflammation and diabetes is called pycnogenol, P-Y-C-N-O-G-E-N-O-L. And there's some really good research. It shows it turns off inflammation. It is great for cardiovascular health. And it is good for impotence because it encourages nitric oxide production. And that supports improved blood vessel dilation, increases blood flow and oxygen to muscles. And then it's great for menopause. In fact, there was a good article in the Journal of Reproductive Medicine that 12 weeks of supplementing with pycnogenol was associated with a noteworthy reduction in perimenopausal and menopausal symptoms, including fatigue, night sweats, hot flashes, and insomnia. So pycnogenol, 100 to 200 milligrams, it's really good for you. That's the latest on health and nutrition. Now I want to share something with you. Just to think about this, I'm concerned that we as a society have not paid attention to the bureaucracies and how they've been growing. Now, there was a time when bureaucracies served the common interest. They saw that we had good public schools and roads, the infrastructures, the bridges, the tunnels, the gas mains, the water mains, the dams, the dikes were all in good functioning order. They also saw that we had good police department and fire departments and Coast Guard, the things that we all are in need of. And then in came the politicians buying votes. And this is something that both Democrats and Republicans have done, making outrageous promises to unions and other groups. And so if you vote for me, I'll give you all this. But this isn't fair. You shouldn't be giving one group something that you don't give everyone. But this is the way business began to be done, and it grew. And then no one paid attention that starting around 1980 or so, the bureaucracies took on a life of their own, especially the military-industrial complex, always looking for war or conflict to inflate its significance. And now the spying, the intelligence agencies, 17 agencies, we don't need this. There's no justification. And yet, every year they get an increased budget, and they're out of control. There's no one to audit them. There's no way to audit them. A lot of what they do are called black ops, and there's no accounting for it. And now we have major industries that have a close working affiliation with these bureaucracies. That's how we get the privatization. And that's how we get private contractors like Halliburton and other companies that profit off war and conflict or destruction. We need to curtail these. We need to audit them. We need to change them. This is from HSLDA. It says, .org, quote, "When parents have a sick child, the last thing they should have to worry about is being falsely accused of child abuse. Unfortunately, this appears to be more and more frequent pattern in the United States. HSLDA is undertaking a new case that reveals a very troubling example of this problem. Any of us could be this family. We could be the parents falsely accused of abuse. We could be the ones who have our children removed from us at the very moment when they need us the most, when they're genuinely ill. Lane Funkhauser and his wife Susan and their two children were all very sick. They went to their family doctor, who was unable to diagnose the problem. Because the children were not getting better, their attendance at school became an issue, so Lane and Susan decided they would homeschool their kids while they searched for a diagnosis and treatment. School officials filed truancy charges against the family, which were quickly dismissed. But as a result of these charges, the family became embroiled with a social worker named Michael Austin, an investigator for the Clark County, Virginia Department of Social Services. Austin is not a doctor. He is not a nurse. He's not a psychologist. He is not a medical professional of any stripe. But Austin determined that Susan was suffering from Munchausen syndrome by proxy. This outdated, worthless term refers to a psychological disorder in which a parent contends that her child is ill to draw attention to herself. It is extremely rare, and it requires a proper diagnosis by a qualified professional. There's one thing we know for sure about this case. Laboratory results showed that the children were actually sick with a difficult-to-treat illness, and it was not the result of Munchausen by proxy. By the time Austin made his diagnosis, the family had found a doctor who determined what was actually going on. The children had a combination of strep, a parasite, and a bacterial infection, the C. diff, and a condition that kills 14,000 Americans each year. They were positive lab results showing that the children had this, and the doctor prescribed treatment for the children for these illnesses. The doctor told the family to go to the hospital for treatment. They went to Rockingham Memorial Hospital, where they were treated and told to return if any symptoms got worse. In the meantime, we believe Austin had shared his Munchausen theory with the hospital staff and other Department of Social Service workers. Frankly, the hospital staff should have known better. They had a diagnosis from a licensed doctor and a valid lab results. But they listened instead to the inventive social worker who was utterly unqualified to be making a diagnosis of any kind. On July 25th, Shenandoah County social workers removed the children from their home. The husband and wife were cooperative, thinking the social workers were simply helping transport the children to the hospital for additional treatment. That's not what happened. The social workers brought the children to the emergency room where, surprised, they were diagnosed with that medical condition and given medication. Despite the fact that the plain medical facts were staring them right in the face, the social workers from this neighboring county decided to pursue Austin's theory. Rather than taking the children back home to their parents for rest and recovery, they put the children in foster care. A week later, the social workers showed up in court to defend their decisions to take away the Funkhauser's children. Even though they now had medical confirmation that the children were actually sick and that Susan wasn't just making up stories to get attention, the judge allowed them to continue the investigation and keep the children in foster care. Meanwhile, in the foster care children's home, the children were interrogated repeatedly by employees of the home who insisted their parents did not love them and that they were never going home, and then tried to get them to give information about how their parents had neglected them. The children had no such information to give, of course, and the Shenandoah County investigations themselves never talked to the children. While in the home, which included foster children who had violent criminal and drug histories, the children were injured. And when it was reported to the staff did nothing, even though the child had, in one case, a broken ankle for 3 weeks untreated. On August 29th, Shenandoah County Department of Social Services finally released the children after being ordered by the court to do so. Their parents immediately took them to a doctor to check, and it turned out that the ankle was broken, not just sprained, and it had been left untreated for 3 weeks. And it turned out that the Frankhauser children had been exposed to tuberculosis while at the children's home. So to compound all their other health problems, they were put on a regimen of anti-tuberculosis drugs for a year. About a month later, Shenandoah County Department of Social Services decided that the initial allegations about the Munchausen was by proxy was unfounded on a, and so the husband and wife received a letter telling them the investigation was closed. But then in court, the attorney for Shenandoah County argued the family still needed court supervision. The family needed it. Why? The judge disagreed. He looked at the medical evidence, some from the Funkhauser's doctor and some from the court's own medical investigator. These facts disseminated the Department of Social Services' claim of the problem. The judge dismissed the petition, and they were free to go home. Well, except that they had to receive several months of counseling to recover from the trauma of being suddenly taken from their parents and held in a frightening home for 5 weeks. Here's the point. Parents shouldn't be afraid to keep looking for medical answers. Taking sick children to doctors until they get a proper diagnosis is good parenting, in my opinion. But too often, looking for the right doctor elicits suspicion from social service investigators and medical staff. So that is not an unusual or an exceptional case. I remember receiving a little handwritten, scribbled note once, and I took a look at it, I read it, and I put it on my desk. It said, "I'm in prison for falsely being accused of, or being convicted of shaken baby syndrome, but it's false. I did not do it. I love my child. Please investigate." I had a lot of other investigations going on, but in time, I looked into it. I interviewed the wife who was in Florida. I called her. I spoke with several other people, and there was nothing in this person's background that gave me any indication that he would have killed his child. So I went down and I began an informal investigation. Within about 9 months, I was convinced that this was a person who had been wrongly convicted and that a bad batch of vaccine had been the cause. I then gave information to several other physicians, and the court was petitioned, and in time, this person was given a new hearing. At the hearing, the state gave their case, and then this man with the attorneys and the experts there gave their case, and he won. In fact, the state didn't even go to the end. It was ended. I remember getting phone calls. We had our cameras set up in the courtroom, and Fox and NBC and CNN, everyone called saying, "We didn't cover that. You're there." And I said, "Yeah, can we use the footage?" I said, "Sure." That was just one example of what happens when we do not take the time to look for the truth. We rush to judgment. And speaking of rushing to judgment, this is something to consider. Do you remember months ago there was a guy who was killed in a police car, but he'd been handcuffed with his, and somehow he managed to get a gun into the car and shoot himself in the back? This is from Tom Buggiani from Raw Story. It just came out from Alternet. Quote, "An autopsy report released this week casts further doubt on a police officer's claim that a suspect committed suicide by shooting himself while handcuffed in the back of a police cruiser. According to the first page of the official autopsy report released by the Iberia Parish Coroner's Office, Victor White, 22, died from a gunshot to the chest, not in his back, as reported by the arresting officer." And then it goes on to show how he was arrested, handcuffed, and then when the officer went inside, came back out, he's found this guy dying. The autopsy showed that the bullet entered White's chest, perforated his left lung and heart before exiting his armpit area and lacerating his upper arm. All right, so a man with handcuffs who is frisked and has no gun ends up being shot in the chest in the back of a police car. And what do they then? Then the autopsy report shows that he was shot in the chest, not the back, and they still call it a suicide. So for those who say, "What is the point of Ferguson?" This really is not about Ferguson. It's not about whether this was a good or not good teenager. This has to do with an entire cop-worshipping society, military-worshipping society. Every one of our soldiers are heroes until they're homeless, until I find them sleeping on the ground in the middle of Florida with no water, no sewage, no medical care, no money, no job, no prospect. And then they say that what they did, they would never do again. As one woman said, "I believed in my country. I believed in what I was doing until I saw what I was doing. And then I was no longer able to be propagandized. I saw the truth. And you want to know why we have post-traumatic stress disorder, Gary? Because all of us who are over there see the truth. Some engage in it because that's a part of their nature. They're psychopaths. Others are disgusted by it, but they don't know how to change it. They come home and they're so imbalanced. The police are supposed to be there to serve, not to be militarized, and not to be judge, jury, and executioner. This is about the larger picture. For every person who has been brutalized, tasered, slapped around, their rights violated, arrested without cause, and then the police, pathological liars that they are, will lie for one another. And the judges, as corrupt as they are, especially in New York City, are you kidding me? In New Jersey, you never want to have anything to do with the judicial system in New Jersey. It's so putrefied. They protect one another. It is a system. So this is not one incident. This is only one spark. And we should pay a little attention, because this has been happening for a long time. But because it hasn't happened to most people, and certainly not the affluent people, and certainly not people who are not of color. And sometimes we'll hear about the outrage when someone of color, like the former top person at a major, I think it was Harvard, one of the universities, was arrested going into his own house. That became an issue. Well, why did it become an issue? Because you're not supposed to do that to a prominent, educated, wealthy, respected black. But if you're just a regular black, you'll never make the news. You'll never get invited to the White House to have a conciliatory beer with the person involved. That's how bad it is. Who aren't we seeing march? Not only in Ferguson, but anywhere. Here's who we don't see. And we won't. We won't see the wealthy. Ever. We certainly won't see their wives or their children, because they're spending all their time buying everything they can. We will not see the highly educated class, the professional class. And with rare exception, there are exceptions, you do not see the architects, you do not see the engineers, you do not see the corporate CEOs, you don't see the people high up in management and board of directors of major corporations. You don't see them. You do not see those who are affluent. You do not see the 40 million Americans living in gated communities ever. Unless it's something having to do immediately with them. If it's something they believe in, then you'll see them. But otherwise, they're invisible. On the racial issue, they're invisible. On the class issue, they're invisible. On the environmental issue, they're invisible. On the political issue with the Tea Party, they'll show themselves, but outside of that, they're invisible. You will not see the vast majority of working class, comfortable people. Who you will see are the poor. They have nothing to lose. And those that support them, the activist class, whether conservative or liberal, and they both have been participating as they see it. Isn't it interesting that we only pay attention when it's something that is so unusual? You're not supposed to, you know, beat up. Could you imagine if Colin Powell searched or beaten up? Could you imagine if any of the successful African Americans, if LeBron James were beaten up and arrested? Then suddenly it's worldwide news. Why should it be? It shouldn't be. If we lived in an ethical, moral, and non-racial society, anyone who is falsely accused, anyone who is falsely harassed, anyone who is targeted based upon their ethnicity, their religion, or the color of their skin, that is wrong. It's about time we're addressing it. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie Heath, babe, and it keeps it out of sight. you know, when that shark bites with his teeth, babe, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, wears old Maggie Heath, babe, so there's never, never a trace of red. Now on the sidewalk,
to welcome all of you, everyone, I'm Gary Knoll. In a few moments, we're going to be going to Portland, Oregon, to talk with my guest on the miseducation of the American elite and the disadvantages of an elitist education. But before then, we have a really nice special for you, and this is what we do to raise money for our non-commercial radio program. We provide you with some special incentive, and today it is the Power Berry Blast that I'm holding in my hand here. This is half of the other red berry, which is red stuff. I couldn't get it all at the amount I wanted in one jar, so I broke it into two. One is called red stuff, the other is berry blast, and here's why. First, this is vegan. It is gluten-free. It is Circle K kosher, and it also has, for example, 5,177 milligrams of cherry juice. Why? Because look at the biochemistry on cherries. Why should we have cherries? Now, I never make a medical claim or health claim, and I won't. But that doesn't mean you can't look up the science. Then look at strawberry. I have 2,580 milligrams of strawberry and blueberry, 2,000 milligrams of blueberry. And then I have raspberry, beets, black currant, cranberry, bilberry, goji berry, aronia berry, acai, grapeseed extract, elderberry, raspberry, camus, nori, pineapple, guava, and black raspberry, and quercetin, all in one jar. It's a big jar. It is 500 grams. So this is what we're offering at a great price. In fact, this is the best special we've ever given on this, the Power Berry Blast. I take it every day. I take it twice a day. In fact, you're going to get this, plus you're going to get the Shopping and Cooking for Good Health DVD documentary with my daughter Shelley and I, showing you what to shop for, how to buy it, what to look for, and then how to prepare it. It's a wonderful special. It is normally $160. You're saving $80. You're paying $79.99. How about that? Raw, all-natural, antioxidant-rich, phytochemical-rich, enzyme-rich. There's nothing like Power Berry Blast. It is one of the four or five most important things I've ever created, and plus the Shopping and Cooking for Good Health. So that's the special. Here's the number to call. You're getting $80 savings. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065 for the Power Berry Blast. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. Let's go out to Portland, Oregon, and say hello to Dr. William Durisovitz. My guest is an essayist, a literary critic, a former professor of English who taught at Yale University for a decade, and his articles and essays have appeared in The Nation, The New Republic, where he is a contributing editor, The New York Times, and The American Scholar, where he also hosts All Points blog. He is the author of several books and is an expert in the life and thought of Jane Austen. He wrote an important article, The Disadvantages of an Elite Higher Education, criticizing the quality of education in the Ivy League classes of universities. It went viral and led to a burst of response from sympathizers and critics alike. And he's with us now. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Over and over again, we have heard the phrase, the best and the brightest, and to refer to privileged men and women who managed to attend the most elite universities in the United States. Then segue into lucrative positions that have enabled them to become, in many cases, not all, wealthy and or powerful. Not always powerful and not always wealthy, but in some combinations. And especially if you look at individuals like George Bush and Al Gore, who, in my opinion, attended these schools not because they're brilliant minds, but because it was enhancing their status in their class. And the status and prestige given to the Ivy League and other sister universities that fall into this elitist group, like Stanford, University of California, Berkeley, Chicago, Duke, and others, have reached such mythic proportions that most people assume unquestionably that these are factories that will groom high-quality leaders to guide the nation and Wall Street and private industry and serve as the best educators for later generations in the future, at least in my mind. And if this belief is an illusion, then I'd like for you to deconstruct it and tell us what actually is occurring in these schools. And by the way, several years ago, an independent organization that ranked medical schools on the quality of education based upon the freedom from corporate interests gave Harvard Medical School a D. Yale received a C minus. And the reason was that these departments and their curriculums became so sold out to private drug companies. So could you take us through what you have observed in these elite universities?
Yeah. Thanks for the question. Thanks again for having me on. I draw on 24 years of experience in the Ivy League, including 10 years teaching at Yale, 5 years teaching at Columbia. You mentioned that 6 years ago I published an essay called Disadvantages of an Elite Education, which has led basically to 6 years of thinking about this, reading about this, talking to people about it. I've heard from hundreds of students. I've talked with hundreds more students on campuses around the country who've invited me to come talk to them. I've also talked to or heard from professors, teachers, parents, employers, academic administrators. There's a big story there that maybe has been told in bits and pieces here and there, but really hasn't gotten the attention it deserves. And it's a story about elite education in general, and specifically elite higher education and the way it shapes the kids who go through it, and as a result, as you suggested in your question, our leadership class, including almost all of our recent presidential nominees going back to 1988, but also much more broadly. I mean, really, I say not even the 1%, but more like the 10%, the upper middle class. Because I'm not just talking about the Ivy League 8 schools. Really, it's, say, 100 schools. And what we've evolved over the last 50 years, since we moved from the old boy WASP network of prep school graduates that would just get sort of automatically accepted to Ivy League colleges, and we moved to what we call meritocracy, which sounds like a great idea. You know, you try to find the best people based on scores, based on tests, rather than on pedigree. But what has happened in practice, the system that has evolved over the last 50 years, is what some people call the resume arms race. Upper class and upper middle class families competing more and more intensively with each other in wealthy suburbs, in well-heeled urban enclaves, like much of Manhattan and some of Brooklyn, to stuff their kids full at great cost, full of educational resources, enrichment programs, sports, music, tutoring, expensive schools, foreign travel. And this becomes the normal way that kids are trained to compete in the admissions process. Not every kid is like this, but this is the norm. This is a typical product of the system. And those are the kids that I found myself teaching at Yale. They were great kids in many ways. They were nice kids. They were, I think, even decent people, really. But they were extremely well prepared in a narrow academic sense. What they weren't able to do is to think for themselves in a broader sense, or to even realize the difference between sort of doing your homework and really thinking deeply and critically about your place in society and the nature of the world. And they also tended to have a great deal of trouble figuring out what they wanted to do in life, because they had just always been jumping through the next hoop that was being held up for them by adults. I mean, the way you get to these schools is to do what the adults want. You become an adult pleaser, a teacher pleaser, a conformist. That's the phrase that gives my book its title, Excellent Sheep, came from the mouth of one of my students as a self-description in a moment of dawning self-recognition. They're excellent in an academic sense. They can get the A's. But they're also sheep, in her words, because they tend to be to herd in a few predictable directions, simply like Wall Street, like consulting companies. I don't even think that it's principally because of greed, although there's certainly a factor there. I think it's because they don't know what else to do. And students have said to me, you know, I might as well do this. They're offering me a lot of money. They often don't even care what I majored in if it's a consulting company. And, you know, it's not, you know, people say find your passion, but I don't have a passion. Well, you know, that's actually a reasonable statement to make. What's not reasonable is that we've created a system where these bright kids can't find out, can't figure out what they really want to do, haven't been able to get in touch with what really matters to them, with their sense of agency as moral individuals in the world. Now, you use the phrase best and the brightest, and I laughed a little bit because no one on campuses where that phrase is ubiquitous seems to remember that that it originated as the sarcastic title of David Halberstam's book about the whiz kids who got us into the Vietnam War. And what I see, you know, they're not the best or the brightest. They just think they are. And I think that best is especially problematic because kids at these schools are force-fed with so much praise from such an early stage in life that they really come to believe that they are better in some kind of metaphysical sense because their test scores are higher. And I think that that very much, all of this really, feeds into what we see among our leadership class over the last few decades. I think it's indisputably true that more and more Ivy Leagues, the Ivy League colleges and a few others like Stanford are producing the top echelons of our leadership class. But they're not doing a very good job. I mean, look at the last 10 or 15 years. We see, not just in government, not just on Wall Street, but in corporations, in universities themselves, in nonprofits, in cultural institutions, a comprehensive failure of our elites. And they're all failing in more or less the same way, and they're all failing in a way that's exactly what you would predict, given the way they've been trained as kids. They also look like excellent sheep, timid, anxious, risk-averse, very self-serving, extremely satisfied with themselves, and largely cut off from the rest of the society that they have appointed themselves to lead. So that's the indictment that I lay out in the book, but I also want to say that half of the book has a positive message. It has a constructive message, not only what we can do as a society, but as I say in the book to the kids who I want to read this book, you can't wait for the adults to get their act together. You need to think about what you want out of your education and how you can avoid the pitfalls of becoming an excellent sheep. And I give them a lot of ways of thinking about it and guidance, and I talk about teaching, and I talk about the liberal arts and humanities.
Could you give us some of those insights now, please?
Sure. I mean, first of all, forget about prestige. Don't pick your college by how highly ranked it is. Don't worry about trying to be as busy as possible, accumulating credentials in college like you were in high school, like the typical kid who goes to those schools is. Probably better to avoid those schools, if only to avoid immersing yourself in an environment that's about the competitive accumulation of credentials where everyone is focused on getting the brass ring and people look at you as if you had two heads. If you talk about doing something after college that isn't prestigious or doesn't put you on the path to wealth or status. I talk about the importance of a liberal arts education and the humanities and thinking about what you need to do in college to become a human being, to become an adult, in other words, in addition to what you need for job and career prep, which is clearly important. I don't slight that, but the purpose of college has always been understood to be both. And, you know, students are really pushed by everyone, really from our president on down, with his unfortunate recent remarks about art history majors, kids are pushed to so-called practical majors like computer science and economics. Now, there's nothing wrong with majoring in one of those things if you're doing it for the right reasons. But the fact is that this conception of practicality is narrow even on its own terms, let alone the larger human terms through which we need to understand what education is really for.
Final question. Thank you. I appreciate that insight. We know that people live in their own state of illusion, especially those in the kind of upper gilded gated communities. They have luxury. They are frequently compartmentalized where their worldview is very small. And I have found some, not all, lack empathy and responsibility towards those outside the system that they are a part of. And they don't see what they're doing as greed. They don't see it as creating any victims. You never hear people who are affluent sitting around talking about how what they've done has caused anyone to suffer. Hedge funds, equity partnerships, the big deal makers. But these are the kids who are groomed in this. This is the they're absorbing this energy, insight, and this kind of wisdom from their parents about how to live. And then they go off to university to try to be prepared to be the student leaders. And then they end up sitting in the White House. We've had three in a row sit in the White House. And they don't see themselves as being influenced by private interests. Rather, they feel they are really representative of the electorate, but then they don't see how those electorate live. They're not in their neighborhoods. They're always going to some fundraiser and socializing with people at Martha's Vineyard or some other place. How do you get the student to realize that the world they have been immersed in may not be the world that exists for the rest of the people?
Well, that's a good question. It's actually four presidents in a row, if you include the first George Bush. I think that's a hard question to answer, because you can't really cogitate your way towards sympathy with people who aren't like you. You have to actually meet them, get to know them, and not in the course of a political campaign where you shake their hands, and not in the course of what these elite institutions refer to as service, where you go and sort of swoop down on the poor unfortunates and sort of help them out because they're so incapable of helping themselves, blah, 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 white messianism or upper-class messianism. I mean, short of going to a public university, and even public universities, the better ones are also a bit sort of class segregated. I mean, I wish I had a good answer for you. I mean, there's a real structural problem here with the way elites are segregated increasingly from the moment they're born. Because, as you know, you talked about gated communities. There's that book, The Big Sort, where we sort of live in like-minded or socioeconomically homogenous, really, culturally homogenous communities now. If you grew up in the 70s and were part of that great experiment in public secondary education where you really had integrated schools and integrated in every sense, not just racially, then I think you had a very different experience. But that's hard to come by now. So what I'm saying is you really need to live and work among people who are different from you to understand and empathize with them. You can't just read about it. You can't just shake their hand. How do you do that? I don't know. All I know is that knowing that it's a problem and having a sense of humility about your place in the world rather than a sense of self-congratulations, which is what the system inculcates from the word go, is at least a start.
Good. I appreciate that. A very important book, a must read. And the blog site is theamericanscholar.org, where the article is The Disadvantages of Elite Higher Education. And that led to the book, The Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of American Elite. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
And all your good work. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone. Real quick in studio, we have, hello, Luann.
Hello,
Luann
Gary.
Panessi.
Hi. I just wanted to make a quick shout out to the audience. As many of you know, we are starting a new health support group. So if any of you out there are overweight, have high cholesterol, have high blood pressure, or have diabetes, and you want to be with some like-minded people who are very motivated to get themselves as healthy as possible, we're going to be doing a 12-week health support group. But you've got to be committed to all 12 weeks. That's the caveat.
Give your number.
It's 631-504-6198. Again, 631-504-6198. I'll be speaking to everyone before they register.
Let's say hello to Utrice Lee. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Hi, Luann. Today, a call for a movement is issued in Ferguson, but there's little evidence of movement where it counts. And international security scholar Nafiz Ahmed discusses the Islamist insurgency and whether it is setting the stage for an apocalypse of global proportions.
Now, you're not going to bring us down, are you?
No.
Good. You tree sleed, hiding in a bunker, waiting for the apocalypse in a moment.